right. Welcome, everyone, to Tech Can't Save Us podcast by Literal Humans. We are incredibly excited today to have James McMillan, the CEO and co-founder of MyNexus, on the pod today. Welcome, James.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, great to have you on. I came across James the other day in like a you know, sort of bull ring, sort of pitch competition, essentially, and was just really impressed with what I saw with MyNexus, and immediately was like, we got to get this guy on the pod. So yeah, we're excited to hear more.
Hope I live up to expectation.
I'm sure. No pressure on this pod. We're pretty chill crew. Well, first things first, James, thank you for being on. And as I said, you're the co-founder and CEO of MyNexus. Let's start there. Tell us more about MyNexus and specifically what problem you're solving for in the kind of tech for good space there.
Sure. It's probably easier actually to start with the problem. So, at kind of heart, early stage entrepreneurial success, if you like, it's pretty much like potluck. So for businesses, that are getting investment, essentially, it's just as likely that they will fail if they don't kind of get investment that comes with like what we call smart money. So, something that comes with a bit of skills, a bit of capability, a bit of help. And essentially, one in 10 businesses succeed. And of the other nine, basically half of those will fail. So it's such like terrible statistics. And we started to look at kind of why that was and how difficult it was to get money. And actually, really, you're restricted to your network. Like, so if you want to get money for your entrepreneurial venture, you've basically just got to go out, pound the pavement, meet as many people as you can, and pitch to anyone who will listen to try and get money. But what that essentially means is that everyone is getting into bed with the wrong people. So you kind of take the money from whoever you can get it from. And that's why kind of if you don't find the smart money, then you don't have the success. So what we are doing at MyNexus is we're trying to change that investment process. So we are using actually games-based assessment tech to actually profile the skills and potential of an entrepreneur. And then we will use that data to actually smart match them to a potential investor on a marketplace. So we're sort of like an eHarmony.com, but for entrepreneurs and investors. So for us, it's about kind of compatibility. So it's all about getting a good fit.
And you said that term games-based assessment, is that right? Can you walk our listeners through what that is?
Yeah, sure. So what we do is, like, there's lots of psychometrics out there, right, where you can answer loads of questions. But the challenge with psychometrics quite often is that we tend to answer sometimes as we want to be perceived, or maybe sometimes as we perhaps perceive ourselves. So, we take a lot of our insecurity maybe into our psychometric testing. So what we are doing is we give you an app where you run a really fun business game that has challenges every turn, kind of asking you questions about, are you going to fire this member of staff? What are you going to do about this problem? And from that, we can take the data and actually map it into sort of skills and behaviors. So we can look at actually whether you have the potential to be a good entrepreneur, but also whether you exhibit some of those skills kind of in real time.
Right. That's really interesting. It seems, all right, so first of all, the eHarmony thing, is there like a more recent one? Do you want to update that? Do you want to say like Tinder or Bumble maybe? Like,
no, because you see, actually, that's kind of the point, is that when we say dating website, people are like, oh, so it's like swipe left. I'm like, but what does swipe left do for you? Like, that's not about compatibility. It's not about matching. That's about cherry picking. eHarmony, we kind of use that because it was the first site that really pioneered the use of sort of psychometrics as a way to, enhance compatibility. And actually their divorce rate of their users is something like half the national average in the US, which is like fascinating. So that's what we're all about. So no, I'm not going to update it.
All right. So much more to say about eHarmony, but we're going to move on. Tech for good, are they? We'll see. So it sounds like the problem you're dealing with, it's massive, right? Like, people talk all the time about the failure rate of startups and how that's, connected to venture capital and things like that, and smart money and things like that. Connect the dots for us between the problem you're solving for and some of these broader systemic problems. So racism, inequality, you mentioned people needing to have connections in order to get the smart money. How's this all connected?
Yeah, so you obviously are nailing it, but you know, the big problem is exactly that if you are limited to your network, there is an obvious start point where, depending on your level of privilege, you obviously have a head start on everybody else. And I think that, you know, that kind of systemic bias, you know, more recently, I guess, has come, you know, and been felt more acutely, I guess, with, like, you know, the kind of Black Lives Matter movement, and people have suddenly had their eyes opened a little bit to the way the world works. And for us in this particular space, you know, less than 1% of all venture capital goes to what we call underfunded communities. So that's people of color, LGBT and female founded businesses. So, you know, these issues actually are born a lot from those systemic problems. You know, the wrong money is going to the wrong people, because if I happen to be born in the right area and have the right skin color and have the right, went to the right school, I can access money. It's really easy. I can get the money for my venture, whereas other people are not afforded that same level of help and support. And it means that they have to get it right faster and more of the time than not, which kind of flies in the face of what entrepreneurialism is about, because actually you learn through failure. So it's sort of really weird. There's this weird paradox around, well, I don't get enough money, so I can't learn enough to actually be a good entrepreneur, because I'm not really given the same chance as anybody else.
Yeah, I think the failure thing is really interesting, because it's like there's all this chatter about fail forward and fail so many times and stuff like that. And it's kind of like, some people can't afford to fail because they have to feed their families, or they're a carer for like an older, you know, an older parent or something like that. And like some of that whole mantra is like very, like for them to take a risk, it's a massive leap, you know, because they don't have as much of a safety net structurally. So I don't know. I mean, and the other thing, I mean, related to that is I've seen some chatter out there about it's, I think the statement was like, it's not the lack of networks that, you know, some of the underfunded folks, you know, might have, like they have networks. It's the persistence of these networks of privilege and wealth that is like the hard nut to crack. So like, how are you solving for that with MyNexus?
Yeah, that is the kind of $64 million question, I suppose. And that's where what we're trying to do is get people away from the pitch. And I suppose, so you saw my pitch, which is kind of funny because you remember at that pitch, you know, they had a panel of four kind of dragons or bulls, or whatever you want to call them. And the two that they picked on both said, I don't know if this is really a massive problem.
I was livid, James. Just about, like I was angry for you. Like I was the one who commented in the Zoom. I was like, he's stating facts. You know what I mean? Like this is a reality. This is just incontrovertible statistics. And you guys are like, oh, we don't know. Grumble, grumble. Like it's just.
It's really, really fascinating. And you kind of watch them. You know, it's kind of. I had maybe 14, 15 people message me after that pitch and said, don't worry about those comments. You know, this is, you're on the right track. Like I've experienced this problem. I feel it. And I guess that for me is the big illustration of how that system works, because those two people who gave feedback, in a weird way, I'm going to say it's kind of not their fault. They just have never experienced it. They don't understand. So I kind of really reflected afterwards and I thought, because I was angry, I was like, "What? How can you not know this fact?" And then I thought, well, that's kind of unfair of me, because I'm expecting you to be in the same position or to have experienced it or to be knowledgeable about it. And actually, if you are in the system and you've never had a problem, then of course you don't think there's a problem. Like, you think it's fine.
But the problem comes in, though, is that, you know, and this is the definition of racism being prejudice plus power, right? So, like, they have a prejudice that this isn't a problem, and then their power is that they then turn around and don't fund underfunded, you know, entrepreneurs. So, like, I don't fault them for the first thing, because they're living in a different reality, but, like, I fault them for the second thing in terms of, and maybe the two are inextricably linked, I don't know, but, like, how do you break that chain, I guess?
Yeah, and that's where what we're doing in terms of the system that we're creating is to break down that problem. So you're right. The issue is, as well, that lots of these investors are, like you say, are getting the opportunities, they're being pitched to, but they're not putting the money in those businesses. And so for us, we're saying, well, the pitch process then is no good, is it? Because it's too biased. But also there's this inequality in power. And what we are trying to do with our system is readdress that. So getting entrepreneurs actually to find out about themselves and their skills, A, so that they know what they're looking for, because I think half the time actually entrepreneurs don't really know. They're kind of going, I'm hoping that if I find the right person with money, they'll tell me what I need, maybe. So maybe I need to do that for them. And the other part is to kind of remove that pitch process almost up front. So kind of match them on the data so that by the time you're having the conversation, you're already in a very different mindset. You're already into, well, actually, I'm interested in the business. I'm interested in their skills. I already know something about them. So it sort of gets over that initial barrier of kind of, actually, you don't look or sound like me, and so I've already switched off, I'm not interested. It sort of gets you beyond that part of the conversation.
It's a very smart approach. I mean, do you have any case studies or just like stories of, you know, examples of how it's worked, like for underfunded entrepreneurs how has it worked?
Yeah, so we've only been going, so we launched our MVP in September. It's now recording this. This is early February. So we've not been going a super long time. And we're definitely still ironing out those MVP kinks. So, you know, that's all good fun. But, you know, we've already had examples of, you know, and particularly a couple of females who have got investment before, really struggled actually, in the worst possible way, with kind of like, you know, sexist investors or whatever, and had some pretty bad experiences, who've come on the platform, just had a connection with somebody, started a conversation, and have then signed up with a partnership or a deal or something, you know, within the space of a few weeks. And so that was really great for us, just in terms of, actually, the first thing that the platform does is just put you in touch with people that you wouldn't normally have access to. And they're already willing participants because they buy into what we're doing. So actually, everyone on the platform is quite nice. You know, there isn't really anyone on there, so far as we know yet, who's, you know, trying to shark it or trying to, you know, sort of manipulate it. So that has been really great, just as a sort of proof of concept moment to go, right, okay, well, great, we put two people together who wouldn't have met, and it's worked. So if we can do that at scale, it will really take off.
Sort of a tech question, because I thought about this, like, you know, I do like freelance writing on the side, I've done some freelance journalism, and I thought about developing an app that basically better connects editors with freelance writers, because right now it's like happening on Twitter, and like, you know, the rates aren't clear and the briefs aren't clear, and it's just like, it's kind of a mess. And I was like, we just need a platform where these two groups can better meet and align, and mostly better for the freelance writers, but also better for the editors. So like, how were these connections happening in the pre-MyNexus world, and how have you navigated getting people onto it, like doing this kind of work on your platform, like the tech piece of it, I guess?
Yeah, I think that's really interesting, because obviously we've used the dating analogy already, and I suppose that what internet dating did for dating in general was it made things, A, more accessible, it gave you more choice, I suppose, but also arguably, and this is where I suppose there's a debate, the use of the tech allows you, I suppose, to get closer to the things that you want. So previously, in the previous world, you would have met someone, been introduced, you know, that set a natural network effect, you know, met them at work, you go on the date without knowing anything about them, you know, so, and you start to get to know them. Whereas what internet dating's done is it's reversed that out. So it said, actually, you get to kind of know each other first, you share data, and then you decide if you want to follow that up with a date. So I'm saving time and energy and money. And actually, that, I suppose, is how our tech works in exactly the same way. So it has been interesting trying to get people to move towards that. But I think that people are so used to these sort of marketplaces or that style of interaction, they're actually pretty fine about it. There's lots of these sorts of platforms around. They just don't do it in the same way as we do.
So I'm gonna follow you down the yellow brick road of the dating apps thing. And I had this professor when I went to school for public policy ages ago. Don't recommend it. Don't study public policy. And he was actually at the law school, and he did this whole study of people on dating apps, and also I think he looked at like Craigslist, like casual encounters, like all that stuff. And what he found was that I need to actually cite his research, but what he found was that like people's prejudices carried through. So, you know, black women are you know, categorically like ignored or underappreciated on these platforms. Asian men are emasculated. Black men are exoticized. You know, like those things still happen because people can still see your data. They see your face. They see your body. Yeah. So I'm curious, like, how does a platform like yours prevent those biases from just being replicated, you know, on the platform?
Yeah, and that's really important to us, actually, and we've learned from that in the past, because you're absolutely spot on. And I suppose there's a really big chat about that. I mean, if you get into the, you know, AI and machine learning and all of that, you know bias is a hot topic, and we're really into it. So we have been really, really conscious right from kind of the moment we came up with the idea, was that we had to make sure as we're designing that we are constantly kind of checking for that sort of bias in everything from how we structure the platform to how much data we collect to what we do with that data. So in a for instance, right, you would think as a platform that is doing this and we want to help underfunded communities, when we sign you up, we should take loads of information from you so that we can measure how successful we were being. And we were like, no, we're not going to do that. We're going to strip that out entirely, because all we're then doing is being guilty of doing this. We're just feeding the problem, actually. And what we really need to do is build a product that overcomes the systemic issues. And ultimately, if that happens, we can do the measuring at the other side, you know, with the success rate. So actually what we can look at is once people have raised investment and have done what they need to do, that's when we can say, cool, actually, can you now tell us all about your diversity? Because what we now want to do is measure what happened. But what we don't want to do is put it in the system and use it as a way in which to kind of produce an outcome. So we were really passionate about making sure that we're constantly challenging ourselves on that, and not, as you rightly say, designing things so that you just perpetuate something else. And a good example of that actually is, and I've seen it today on LinkedIn, was, you know, female investment. There's a massive industry around female investment, right? How do we get investment into women? Okay. The numbers have not moved in 10 years. They're still the same, but we've got this massive industry around it. And I saw a comment on LinkedIn today that said, isn't this great? A new VC fund made up of female investors. So, you know, now that the females are making the decisions, they will, you know, invest in more female-led businesses. And you're like, they might. You know, there was a study at Harvard about 10 years ago where they did a blind kind of pitch test, and they looked at, you know, females and males and how, if it was presented by a different voice, you know, what would the outcome be? And even female investors weren't investing in the women, because the point is the systems train them that way. So it's like, well, you can't, you know, you've got to get out of the rabbit hole at some point. You know, you've got to actually shake it up. And just because a woman is in charge, that doesn't necessarily mean she is also going to follow that through, you know. And I think that's important.
That's really real. I mean, that's, yeah, and that tracks, I think, with the research that I've seen around, you know, essentially, like, you know, if you ask someone about to identify their gender or their race right before they take a test, like that becomes sort of their veneer for taking the test, and that all the biases that they've heard about that exist in society then come through in those test results, you know, because we're all dealing with internalized oppression to some degree. So that seems super smart. The other piece, like I think about also Airbnb. Like, you know, I'm a black American man who lives in the world. Like, I've definitely gotten cancellations out of the blue just because of who I am. But now Airbnb has changed their policy where hosts can't see your face, your picture, until you've booked, right? Which is like super a smart way, I think, to maybe, I mean, get around that. So, yeah, what you're saying tracks. I'm curious where you found allies and resistance in the tech for good space specifically.
Everywhere, they're everywhere, all of them. Whether it's allies or resistance, you never know who you're talking to, I think is my message. Do you know, and actually investors particularly so, because they have this circular discussion with themselves where they want help and support, but then at the same time, they're like, oh, I don't have time to for your new technology. And I'm like, well, it's gonna, well, okay, never mind.
They're also probably like, am I the problem? Because there's a lot of identity stuff in what you're talking about too, of like, because you're starting with this implicit critique, explicit critique of the sector. So like, that's, yeah, that's big.
Yeah, it, definitely. So we've found kind of lots of resistance, definitely from within the sector or the industry, and occasionally with, weirdly with people in tech, which I always find interesting, where I don't know, maybe it's just an old school mentality where they sort of hear what we're doing and they're like, well, you know, that'll never work. And I'm like, okay, that's fine. But I think what we have found in kind of allies is that there are, you know, some quite obvious spaces. And I think tech in general for me has been very supportive of what we're doing and excited by it. But for us, actually, we find kind of allies and advocates a lot just within our kind of customer base in places where we wouldn't even think to find them. So we're always just kind of reaching out to people to talk about what we're doing. And then we sort of use that as a screening test to see, and we see what reaction we get. And then we're like, okay, if you're into it, then maybe you can help us. Because I think when people really believe in the issue, I think they want to do everything they can to make sure you succeed.
So, I mean, even stepping back a little bit, I'm curious, like, to that critique that you're making on the sector, what made you choose like a systems problem rather than something lower order that's like, you know, just a communication device between investors? And like, you could have gone there and probably made a bunch of money, but like, you chose to take on the, you put the system on trial. Like, so yeah, what made you do that?
Yeah, stupidity and belligerence. I think, yeah, to be honest, it was like, we didn't really see any other solution. So my co-founder Gaynor, right, is like, she won't thank me for saying this, but she is a woman in her 50s. You know, I'm a white gay guy in my 30s. And we actually worked together because she had a tech startup in beauty tech, and I was a business advisor. So my background's actually finance, like I'm an accountant. And I was helping her with her business, but she'd also been working and she'd helped to set up this investment club, and she had basically experienced all these problems. And having done her tech bit, she was talking to me about this idea, and she said, look, I think I've got this kind of mad idea about using gaming to screen entrepreneurs for skills and then helping them match and get through a transaction. And so sort of we co-founded it together. But every time we started to do the research on it, every group we spoke to, every round table we held, we just kept coming back to the same root cause, that it was about the wrong people getting together, doing the wrong deals. And we'd started with that tool going, oh, this is obvious. It just needs a, like you say, a communication platform transaction tool where you screen them doing due diligence. And then I was like, well, it's a bit late then, isn't it? I was like, because you're already getting ready to sign the check. Like, you actually, this is worse than that. This is about why, how do people meet? Why do people meet? Who do you have access to? And that was when we really connected the bias and the inequality. And we sort of were like, yeah, that's why we're experiencing this problem. So yeah, we kind of felt like we didn't really have a choice, but we were also probably just crazy enough to really give it a go. And I think that being independent of the industry, we feel able to do that. We're kind of like, actually, we've got experience in this industry. We've worked in it. We've worked around it. We've been involved in the ecosystem. But actually, we're not embedded in that system. So we can change it because we don't have an agenda. Our only agenda is to make everyone's lives easier, investors and entrepreneurs. So who wouldn't want that?
So, I mean, maybe you've already answered this already, but, and maybe this thing that you just mentioned is the learning, but like, what was the learning that most surprised you as you started building MyNexus?
Heavily connected into that, I think, was around, you know, deciding actually what we were going to put in our MVP and actually correlating that into kind of how our customers feel about their problem. And I suppose what's interesting is you're right. We've got this dysfunctional system. We've actually got two sets of customers. So I've got a dual marketplace. I've got investors on one side and entrepreneurs on the other. And we had a huge debate when we were starting in our discovery, you know, around, okay, let's do our Moscow session. What's going into the MVP? And I was really strong view around, this has to meet like a better standard than your average tech MVP. I was like, investors are not going to fly for something that's half built, but it's a great proof of concept. I was like, they're just not going to be interested. And I was right. But I think what surprised us the most actually was that even though we knew that, we still didn't hit the mark. So yeah, so we kind of, and actually we'd completely overestimated as well, I think, the entrepreneur's problem. So what we really found was the entrepreneur felt really strongly about their problem with raising investment. So all we have to say to them is, I've got a platform that will introduce you to investors, and when you start to tell them about the rest of it, they stop listening. They're like, great, I'll sign up. Like, they're dead happy that, like, that's how big a problem it is for them, so they don't care. The investors, even though we've kind of built something that we think is like reasonably high quality, and you know, we're almost there and we're going to integrate the game, they're a bit like, okay, well, show me when it's done. Show me when you've got another 10 entrepreneurs. You know, well, I don't know. I'm just not sure right yet. So we know there's still a bit of a kind of psychological barrier for them. And I think that has definitely been a big learning, that we, even though we understand them, we didn't understand what the strength of that feeling was.
So we're gonna pivot a little bit and move into our sort of like lightning round, quote unquote, of our Tech Can't Save Us patented questions. Curious about your work specifically. So what kind of tech stack do you work with, and what has been like a game changing tech product in your work specifically?
Yeah, okay. So I have to make full disclosure, right? I'm a proper CEO, right? So I'm the pseudo techie. So I did check in with my CTO before you know, coming on here and making sure I understood everything. But so we actually use a LAMP stack, and you know, nothing groundbreaking about that. But for us, what's been kind of game changing actually is at a much lower level using Laravel. So for us, that really helps us kind of get around, you know, really big technical integration issues, you know, things like integrating payment merchants, you know, email notifications. So what it has allowed us to do is really focus on core functionality, and then kind of future looking, we're already kind of looking at the next versions and thinking this will be great actually for us to be able to, you know, produce a kind of ultra modern experience, but with a fraction of kind of that dev time. So actually for us, it's kind of like, keep it simple, stupid, you know, that's the best approach.
And then I guess related to that, quick follow-up, like what's the process? Like if you're an entrepreneur and you want to get on the platform, what does that flow look like for them?
Yeah, so it's really straightforward actually. It's kind of like you sign up with your email, we send you a little invitation to come on, so it's kind of golden tickets at the moment, and it takes like 2 minutes to click through a few boxes and set up kind of your criteria around, you know, what kind of business you are, and then once you're on the platform, so the onboarding is really short actually. It's literally about filling in a profile. So it's completing questions, uploading a pitch deck, uploading a video if you want to. So kind of dressing your shop window. And that's kind of the basis of the platform. And in about 6 weeks, we will have our entrepreneurial skills index tool, which will actually then allow you to also measure your kind of skills and capability so that you can feed that into your profile as well.
So part of what we talk about on Tech Can Save Us is tech for good and sort of defining it. And it's just an ongoing piece of the conversation. But one of the threads of that is like, we don't need tech for everything, and tech can't solve anything, as the name suggests, or everything. So what would you say is a problem that tech can't solve for us?
So I was having a really good think about this. And I think that tech can't solve kind of our ethical issues. So it's broad. And I actually think there's loads of examples of where, in fact, tech is really bad at creating ethical issues. I think actually if you remove the tech, it wouldn't be a problem. But anything from, you know, or self-driving cars, which, great, you know, you're going to stop millions of deaths caused from human error. But then we have to design into that product, you know, who you are going to kill least in which situation.
I heard about this. Like, I heard, like, it's like if the car has to go into, like, a mother pushing a stroller or an old person, it's going to pick the old person. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. It's just...
And so what is it? It's the classic trolley dilemma, isn't it, right? So it's, do you switch the track for the trolley that's out of control? And you can't, you know, fix those problems. And I think even things like, you know, contactless payments, what an amazing, you know, incredible time-saving invention. And it's so innocuous. And yet, you know, that one piece of tech has just, you know, removed money from the hands of how many homeless people around the world. So it's creating these massive kind of strange tech problems, in fact. And I think that the one problem tech can't solve for me is ethics. It's really difficult.
That's well said. That's actually one of the things that surprised me, obviously being American in the UK, is like the contactless stuff. Like in the States, there's laws, and look, we're no bastion of ethics or anything, you know, that stuff, obviously. But like there's laws on the books a lot of places where, you know, businesses have to accept cash for the very reason you mentioned, because of people who are unbanked or, you know, houseless or whatever. And they just don't have credit cards, and they don't have smartphones with like their, you know, credit card on it. So, and then to come over here and see just the total contactless, you know, yeah, it was pretty shocking to me. I was like, wow, this is really, yeah. Anyway, so along those lines, we like to talk about not just tech for good, but tech for bad as well. What's the evilest application of technology that you've seen out there?
So for me, the evilest kind of application of tech is actually kind of manipulation of technology itself. And I guess what I mean by that is, so, you know, being the accountant with the finance background, like my head immediately went to sort of like fraud and kind of the use of tech to kind of dupe people. And I think if you go back 20 years, right, so I think we're probably old enough to remember, like, you know, the original phishing scams and kind of, you know, send me your bank details, I'll send you $1 million from whichever foreign country, you know, I might be from. And I think we used to think people, you know, oh, you'd be pretty dumb, you know, if you got that wrong. Whereas now it's like deep fakes, impersonation, social media bots spreading misinformation, you know, and you've got this kind of real impact on people's lives, even down to things like the number of fake e-commerce sites there are that are peddling really awful, you know, quote unquote, consumer goods around the world. And consumers are just kind of going, what am I going to do with this? Like, I've lost that money, and then I've got this terrible piece of tat, and I can't send it back, and I can't do anything about it. And I think there's this kind of accountability within the tech ecosystem is almost the worst evil application. And what's worse is that we kind of see it as part and parcel of the system. So I must be so raging against the system at the moment, but you know, I think it's hard.
Okay, so flipping that question sort of on its head, you know, if you could dream up a new tech product, you know, besides My Nexus, what would it be, and what problem would it solve, and for whom?
So variations on a theme. I would like to dream up a tech product that would save us from tech. So bear with me. So wouldn't it be amazing, right, if you could create kind of something that could automate and improve productivity, but in a way where instead of filling that gap with more productivity and giving the humans more jobs, actually we could free up time. You know, I think it always feels to me that tech, and there's been some incredible automation, you know, in the past sort of, you know, 20 years, 10 years, but it feels like we're working harder than ever, and that actually, you know, really it would be nice to give us all a bit of time back and to recalibrate perhaps, you know, the difference between life and work. And maybe we need saving a little bit from tech, and we need to create some tech solutions that would actually improve productivity in a way that allows us to do human things, which I think would be nice.
Cool. Okay. So along those lines, like what would you say is your big prediction for tech for good, like the space, the sector, the subsector, for 2021 and beyond?
So I think, so I mean, you know, capturing that whole topic, to be honest, everything we've talked about today, I think we're going to see a big movement, I think, towards this sort of more ethical approach, actually, to things like AI and machine learning. I think that this sort of concept of digital humanity and kind of people challenging the bias within AI and machine learning, how they're being processed, you know, what we're using this technology for. I almost think that evaluation for design bias will start to become its own little discipline. I think you're going to see kind of technicians, if you like, who are going to move into this space of, actually, I'm working in tech to help design things in almost the best way possible. So to really kind of think and screen out some of these problems. Because I think ultimately the people will fight back against the machine. I don't think, you know, robots are going to take over the world.
Terminator, man. T1, yeah, Skynet's kicking off.
I appreciate last year, or maybe even now, we still feel like maybe that wouldn't be so bad a thing if it happened.
We're just about the end of our time here, but this last question. So when we talk about tech for good, we like to, you know, think about, as a career, it's a lot of people trying to balance profit and purpose. So what's worked really well for you in terms of doing that in your own life?
Yeah, so I'm very fortunate. I've worked since I was 13. I grew up in a family business. And I think, you know, having done that for that long, I think I've always had two principles, you know, instilled in me right from the get-go. You know, I think the first is that you pay for the role, not the person. So always kind of reward in the right way and give everybody a fair shot. But, you know, almost like don't try and scrimp. And the second is that, you know, if you create amazing customer experiences and value, people will pay. So actually, the thing to focus on is not kind of the business model, if you like. It's to focus on whether you're fixing someone's problem and whether you've got something that's good. So for me, like what we do at Join My Nexus is, it's customer first innovation. You know, that is the primary. And we focus on that first around, well, what is the innovation we can create? And then what we do is we innovate a business model to go with it. So we don't restrict ourselves by, you know, making profit. What we say is, if this is the problem we're going to fix and this is how it's going to work, can we monetize that? You know, can we then make that then a good business that's sustainable and will keep people in jobs and will grow the economy? You know, that's our goal. It's not to make profit. So weirdly, we find that kind of easy, I suppose. You know, business model second. If you've got a good product, it will happen.
Yeah, I think that's super smart. And I think that speaks to that last point about the intentionality and the sort of reframe that's happening now. If people are going in trying to solve problems for the world and for communities, and then, yeah, can we monetize this? Should every tech thing be monetized? Not necessarily. So, like, having that bit of humility and sort of respect for problem first, monetization second. People obviously need to get paid and pay their bills and stuff like that.
Great example, I suppose, is what we're doing. And people say, immediately investors will go, oh, so you're taking a cut of the deal. Is that how you make your money? And I'm like, no, because I don't want to take people's investment money. The point is, they need that money. Like, so I will just, you know, low cost subscription, like, that they can afford and that they only pay for when they use. So free for life. And they're like, what? I don't get it. And I'm like, of course you don't, because you're old fashioned, but that's cool.
That's awesome. Well, James, this has been an awesome conversation. I'm really grateful for your time and your expertise and just sharing your stories and your experiences. And just a big thank you to James McMillan, co-founder and CEO of MyNexus. And it's been great to have you on.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
You bet. All right, James, thanks so much.